You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 145, Ezekiel chapter 31. I'm the layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. How you doing, Mike?
Pretty good. It's been an interesting week. I've spent most of the week snowed in.
Well, that's fun. I'm down here with, it's hot. It's like 80 degrees down here. I'm burning up, so I will gladly trade places with you right now.
When I left the Midwest, I thought, this is awesome. I'll never see this again. this kind of weather.
Wrong.
Yeah. It's been kind of brutal. So,
well, that's snow days are fun. You get to snuggle up with your pug, read some books, drink some hot cocoa.
We did all that. But the thing is, it's like, if you want to go anywhere, you're just trapped, couldn't get out of my driveway. Our road doesn't get plowed. No chains, nothing wintry to actually help us out. But,
What a perfect thing to do is on those days is to sit back and listen to the Naked Bible Podcast.
There you go. Absolutely.
Hopefully Absolutely. Your fellow snowed in buddies are all listening to the Naked Bible Podcast.
Yeah. So next time we get a little taste of the apocalypse here, There you go. Yeah, the Hoth system, I guess. And we'll know what to do.
Favorite one right there. Favorite one. Now, number eight is coming up in Christmas. Empire is your favorite?
Yeah. Yeah. It's one of two movies that I've seen double digit times.
Oh, what's the other one? Let me guess. Did you already say it?
No, I was going to. I said part of it. See if you can guess.
You said Prince. It sounded like Prince. Pirates, maybe.
Yeah,
I was going to say Raiders of the Lost Ark, but
no,
that was my guess. So what is it?
The Princess Bride.
Oh, The Princess Bride. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Every time it's on TV, it's like, I keep moving. Cause if I sit down, I'm going to be there for 2 hours.
Do you know the line? What's his name? My name is, what is it?
Inigo Montoya. You killed my father. Prepare to die.
There you go. Yeah. Perfect.
And of course, Wallace Shawn with Inconceivable. Okay, we got to get off.
Oh my gosh. That's awesome. That's an awesome movie.
So those are the two. Those are the two I've seen double digits. So
little Heiser trivia right there. We'll save that for something down the line.
Yeah, something. We'll see. Well, the week's over. We're getting back to normal and here we go back into this will help me feel a little bit more normal, to get back in the recording mode. Listeners might be wondering, well, he said chapter 31, I thought it was going to be 31 and 32. Well, so did I, but maybe it's just because I got snowed in that I went a little crazy, with the research. And I thought, well, there's just so much content here. We got to stick to 31. So we'll do chapter 31 in this episode. Then the next episode, we'll hit 32. I don't want to really trim it down because you're just going to miss some good stuff. So we'll stick with chapter 31. Listeners may already know what the chapter is about as far as the theme. Scholars like to refer to this as the felling of the cosmic tree. So this is like tailor-made for the kind of stuff we do. There's a lot of divine counsel connection that we're going to be talking about with this chapter. But I should sort of issue a warning. This is really dense material, but I can say that on the one hand to kind of like, warn maybe people who haven't listened to too many episodes that, we're going to be wading into some dense content here that parts of which, might sound foreign, be hard to follow. It's okay. I'm going to give you the resources. That if you subscribe to the newsletter, you will actually get some really, really good stuff on the content of Ezekiel 31. And again, divine counsel stuff. We're going to get into Mount Hermon today. Again, that ties in, with my book that's, due out imminently here. So there's a lot of stuff that you can get by listening, but you can get a lot more stuff if you subscribe to the email list. So to do that, you just go to drmsh.com. Right-hand side, sign up for the newsletter, the email list, and you're going to get articles that I'll reference here today. So On the one hand, it's going to be a little dense, but on the other hand, this is also a good illustration of how this podcast gives people, normal people, access to high scholarship. That really is part of our mission. My attitude is, even if people aren't trained in grad school programs in Hebrew Bible and the ancient Near East, even though you can't digest it all, you should still be exposed to it. And since a lot of it's not free online, again, you get it with the newsletter. That's the way I can deliver it to you. So please do that. We're going to be in for a good ride here with the cosmic tree. And again, we're arms dealers here. We're not afraid to give you content. Some people, you know, believe it or not, I get criticized for stuff I write, and even things like the podcast occasionally, that, oh, you're exposing people with all this content. They don't really know what to do with it. You know, that it's like giving people a gun and they don't know how to use the thing. Well, okay, thanks for the analogy. I'm an arms dealer. I'm a content arms dealer. This is what we do here. So if you're new to the podcast, this is what you're going to get. This will be a good illustration. So let's jump in here to the chapter. I'm just going to read the chapter. It's not that long. And there are going to be some things that just pop out to you right away that you're going to say to yourself, if you are a frequent listener or if you have read The Unseen Realm, you're going to think, oh yeah, Mike's going to park on this. Okay, some of it's just that obvious. So first verse here, in the 11th year, in the third month, on the first day of the month, the word of the Lord came to me. Son of man, say to Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and to his multitude. So let me just pause right here and say, this is not just for Pharaoh. We're going to come back to that point in a moment. But son of man, say to Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and to his multitude, the Egyptians, whom are you like in your greatness? Behold, Assyria was a cedar in Lebanon, with beautiful branches and forest shade and of towering height, its top among the clouds. The waters nourished it, the deep made it grow tall, making its rivers flow around the place of its planting, sending forth its streams to all the trees of the field. So it towered high above all the trees of the field. Its boughs grew large, and its branches long from abundant water in its shoots. All the birds of the heavens made their nests in its boughs. Under its branches all the beasts of the field gave birth to their young, and under its shadow lived all great nations. It was beautiful in its greatness, in the length of its branches, for its roots went down to abundant waters. The cedars in the garden of God could not rival it, nor the fir trees equal its boughs. Neither were the plane trees like its branches. No tree in the garden of God was its equal in beauty. I made it beautiful in the mass of its branches, and all the trees of Eden envied it that were in the garden of God. Therefore, thus says the Lord God, this is verse 10, because it towered high and set its top among the clouds, and its heart was proud because of its height, I will give it into the hand of a mighty one of the nations. He shall surely deal with it as its wickedness deserves. I have cast it out. Foreigners, the most ruthless of nations, have cut it down and left it. On the mountains and in all the valleys its branches have fallen, and its boughs have been broken in all the ravines of the land, and all the peoples of the earth have gone away from its shadow and left it. On its fallen trunk dwell all the birds of the heavens, and on its branches are all the beasts of the field. All this in order that no trees by the waters may grow to towering height or set their tops among the clouds, and that no trees that drink water may reach up to them in height, for they are all given over to death, to the world below, among the children of man, with those who go down to the pit. Thus says the Lord God, verse 15, on the day the cedar went down to Sheol, I caused mourning. I closed the deep over it and restrained its rivers, and many waters were stopped. I clothed Lebanon in gloom for it, and all the trees of the field fainted because of it. I made the nations quake at the sound of its fall, when I cast it down to Sheol with those who go down to the pit. And all the trees of Eden, the choice and the best of Lebanon, all that drink water, were comforted in the world below. They also went down to Sheol with it, to those who are slain by the sword. Yes, those who were its arm, who lived under its shadow among the nations. Whom are you thus like in glory and in greatness, among the trees of Eden. You shall be brought down with the trees of Eden to the world below. You shall lie among the uncircumcised with those who are slain by the sword. This is Pharaoh and all his multitude, declares the Lord God. That's the end of the chapter. That's Ezekiel 31. Now, you know, there's just a lot of places that we could drill down here, but I just want to draw your attention to a few things, and then we're going to get into something that's a lot wider thematically. This is, like other chapters in Ezekiel, like Ezekiel 28, okay? The writer is describing not just Pharaoh here, but the whole nation of Egypt, the Egyptian empire, the might of Egypt, casting them by analogy to something. And he actually, you know, brings Assyria into it. So as before the Egyptian empire, you know, before they were a big deal, again, try to think historically now to Ezekiel's time period. Before the Egyptians were a factor, a serious factor in this part of the world, again, in relation to the people of God, and this is really during the monarchy, we'll say, who were the big enemies to the Israelite monarchy? Well, it was the Assyrians. Okay, we've talked about the Assyrians before in the podcast, in the book of Ezekiel, again, the Klingons of the Old Testament. They were feared for lots of legitimate reasons. But historically, their power faded, and Egypt became the big stick on the block. But here we have in this chapter, and we've had other indications in the oracles against the nations in the two earlier chapters, that Egypt's time is going to fade, and they're going to be dealt with by the new power in the area that God is going to use to judge his own people and Egypt, and that is Babylon. So, you know, we have a reference here to the prophet addressing the Egyptians and saying, hey, remember Assyria? Remember how awesome they were? Remember how powerful they were? He actually compares Assyria, okay, Assyria, again, to this tree. And again, using an analogy, and of course the point is, well, what precisely is the analogy? What is he comparing Assyria to that would make sense to the hearer? Again, to someone, you know, from ancient Israel who would read this later on, you know, what they're going to know what Assyria was about, but what's the other point of analogy? Now, clearly, it has something to do with Eden, okay, because Assyria is being compared to this magnificent tree. Again, what scholars are going to call the cosmic tree, the world tree. We'll get into that concept in a moment. Assyria is being compared to it, and God's telling the Egyptians, look, hey. They were just great, but they fell. They fell, Assyria fell because of their hubris. I judged them, again, because of their arrogance. And I'm going to judge you for the same reason. So we're getting sort of, you know, a comparison with Assyria. That's the guts of the warning here. And the prophet is using, you know, he's describing their downfall, the mighty Assyrians that everyone was afraid of. He describes their downfall in this cosmic tree thing going on, this you know, and he links it to Eden, this Edenic analogy, again, whatever it is. And he wants the Pharaoh and the Egyptians to listen to this because their fate is going to be the same. If Assyria was judged, who do you think you guys are? Okay, I'm going to bring somebody along to judge you. And of course, we know from other parts, you know, of the Old Testament, other parts of the prophets, you know, that Babylon's going to get judged too. You know, we don't get that in the book of Ezekiel, because in the book of Ezekiel, the Babylonians are God's instrument of you know, justice against the nations and to judge his own people. But for instance, a book like Habakkuk, this is what the book of Habakkuk is about. Habakkuk says, hey, you know, what about the Babylonians? They're worse than we are. I mean, they're just awful. Aren't you going to judge them too? And God says, yeah, I'll get to them. Okay. So we get that in the Old Testament, but here we are in Ezekiel 1. And so we need to start thinking about what the chapter actually says. Who are the points of analogy? It's not just one guy. It's not just Pharaoh. And I'm bringing that up because there are a lot of scholars, just like in Ezekiel 28, that will read Ezekiel 31 and say, oh, just like, you know, Ezekiel compared, you know, the king of Tyre, the prince of Tyre, the king of Tyre to Adam, you know, and said, hey, Adam fell, and you're going to fall too. So now we get Ezekiel telling Pharaoh that you're going to fall just like, believe it or not, Adam. You say, well, we just read the whole chapter. Where's Adam in there? Yeah, he's not in here. But scholars put him there because of the reference to Eden, and they put him there because of what they do in Ezekiel 28 to get Adam into the text. Now, we talked about that in a previous episode. If you haven't listened to that episode yet, I recommend doing that. But they're going to treat Ezekiel 31 the same way. And from the get-go, the very beginning of the chapters just tells you that that's misguided, because he says, "Son of man, say to Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and to his multitude." This is not about Pharaoh. This is about the Egyptian empire. And that's why it's being compared to the Assyrian empire. So right away, if you're looking at this passage thinking this is about Pharaoh, and the right analogy for Pharaoh would be a guy in Eden. Well, the only guy in Eden was Adam. You're already down the wrong path just from the get-go. But that's where a lot of people are. Now, I want to go back and unpack a lot of this, and you're going to see how problematic this is. And I also hope you see how cool what actually is going on is, what the point of analogy is. What's the other side of the analogy? Questions like, well, why even bring Eden into the discussion? And when you do, why are you associating Eden with Lebanon? Okay, Lebanon, again, if you're familiar with your biblical geography, Lebanon is going to be to the north. Again, here we go already with the cosmic north idea. If you've read Unseen Realm, this is going to be familiar territory. But we've got Lebanon in the north. This is, you know, again, we know where Lebanon is in modern times in the Middle East. Well, it's the same, you know, same place, same country, so to speak. But you have Lebanon to the north. There's going to be a mountain range there, actually a couple of them. Lebanon is going to be known for its cedar forests, and that's part of this chapter. But then it gets lumped in with Eden, and you think, what in the world is Ezekiel doing? Why is he comparing Eden, the garden of God, with Lebanon? Because if we go read Genesis and the four rivers there of Eden, that's just nowhere, that's Tigris and Euphrates. That is nowhere near Lebanon. What is he doing? Okay, it's about the cosmic abode of God, or the cosmic abode of the gods. Okay, that whole cosmic mountain concept you're going to have in your head to be able to track with this. So hopefully you've read Unseen Realm. Hopefully, again, you've listened to the previous episode in Ezekiel 28, because we're going to draw on things in both of those. But it's really, really cool. There's going to be sort of a content surprise or two that we're going to hit on today. So let's go back to the passage we have there. You know, son of man, say to Pharaoh, king of Egypt, to his multitude, who are you like in your greatness? Like, who do you think you are? Behold, Assyria was a cedar in Lebanon. Well, the Assyrian Empire wasn't in Lebanon. And why would you compare it to a cedar? If you're going to compare it to a tree, why a tree in this place called Lebanon? Again, right away, we're like, what in the world is going on? And then you get this whole description. Did you notice how frequently in the description of this Lebanon place, okay, we get references to forestry, and we get references to a well-watered place? Verse 3, forest shade, beautiful branches. He's talking about this tree, you know, the great cedar in Lebanon. Verse 4, the waters nourished it. The deep, and guess what the word is there? Tehom. Okay, again, the primeval deep that you get from Genesis 1. The deep made it grow tall. The deep is part of Israelite cosmology. Think of Israelite cosmology. You have a three-tiered universe. You have the earth, that's the middle tier. That's where people dwell. Above it, again, you've got this firmament dome, and God lives above it, and the waters above the firmament and all that stuff. And then below, you have the waters below, that Sheol, the underworld, is described as a watery abyss, okay? This should be familiar, and if you're listening to this podcast or read Unseen Realm or a lot of other my stuff, you're going to know about Israelite cosmology. That's going to become a big deal here, because the idea of a cosmic tree is part of ancient Israelite cosmology, the three-tiered universe. Back to verse 4, we get a reference to the waters. We get a reference to the deep, to home. Verse 4, we also get a reference to rivers and streams. Verse 5, there's a reference to abundant water. Then we get the description of how magnificent the tree is. Then verse 7, abundant waters. Verse 8, the cedars in the garden of God could not rival it. No tree in the garden of God. Verse 9, all the trees of Eden envied it that were in the garden of God. Again, you have abundant references to trees, forests, and a well-watered place. Just store that away for now. Again, the impression is this has something to do with Eden, but how is this possible? Well, let's start with how this language is usually interpreted by scholars. Scholars typically will note, if you have a good commentary, something that tries to take the text seriously, gets into the text, scholars will note that the passage obviously draws on the notion, this idea, this concept of the world tree or the cosmic tree. Again, you have to conceive of this. It's hard for us because we're modern. You have to think of a giant tree whose boughs reach to the heavens. I mean, the very heights of the heavens, even beyond the sky. It's planted on earth, though, so the tree is as tall as the sky is. And then its roots descend into Sheol to draw up this water. Again, it's watered by the abyss, by the deep. Okay, so this tree is like a pole or a column that runs right through the earth. And again, if you're thinking about Israelite cosmology, to the Israelite, ancient people, very typical worldview that the earth was a round, flat disk. It's set on top of pillars. It's surrounded by water. Underneath it is water in the underworld. It's covered by the dome, that meets the edges of the horizon, where light and dark, are separated. That's Proverbs 8. Again, lots of references to this. I have a whole lecture that's online about Israelite cosmology. But running through the center of this is this gigantic, enormous tree whose branches go to the heavens and whose roots go down to Sheol. By the way, that's something that the flat earthers won't tell you about, will they? In other words, they'll make a big deal that Ohizer and others, talking about Israelite cosmology. Well, we have to believe that the earth is flat because, that's what the Bible says. Well, the Bible talks about the world tree too. And I don't know about you, but we ain't running into a giant tree whose branches extend to the heavens and whose roots go down to Sheol. So the flat earthers conveniently forget that part of ancient Israelite cosmology. Again, believing this in the modern world is as dumb as it sounds, but the language, again, the YouTube videos, whatever you get on the earth is really flat, none of them touch this. They just don't. They're either ignorant of it or they just conveniently forget it. But it's part of biblical cosmology. Now, Allen, in his commentary, his Word Biblical Commentary, the second volume on Ezekiel, pages 124 and 25, says this, he puts it this way. After the direct rhetorical question of verse 2b, the story is told of a magnificent tree, a mythological cosmic tree. From verse 10, the story takes a sinister turn as the tree is accused of pride and wickedness. And Yahweh describes how he had it cut down and humiliated. In verses 15 through 17, the ritual mourning for the tree and its descent to Sheol are related, while verse 18 returns to the present and to direct address to a threat of future punishment that echoes the language of Sheol used earlier. So I'll continue a little bit more. Verse 18 has a summarizing role, presenting the chapter in a nutshell with greater clarity. The motif of the cosmic tree is well attested in ancient mythology. It presents the living world as an enormous tree with its roots in the subterranean deep and its top in the clouds, a shelter for every living being. It is a separate motif from that of the tree of life. So we're not talking about the tree of life here. This is something different. Although the two were often linked, as later in this poem, they're both in Eden, so they both get talked about. The motif came to greatest prominence in Indian, that's ancient India, and Scandinavian mythology. There is some evidence of it in Sumerian and Mesopotamian literature. Now, there certainly is, and we're going to talk about that as well. And Allen theorizes it must have been from Mesopotamian culture that Ezekiel became aware of it and utilized it for the allegory. End of quote. Now, Block says this, Ezekiel's description of Assyria as a cedar in Lebanon is remarkable, especially since ancient reliefs since ancient reliefs usually associate Assyrian kings with the date palm. But the cedar was a well-known ancient Near Eastern symbol of majesty, referred to as the glory of Lebanon, Isaiah 35:2. From the second millennium, the cedar was especially valued for the construction of palaces and temples. The source of Ezekiel's dendritic imagery, again, it's tree imagery, has evoked a great deal of discussion. The resemblance to the majestic Meshu tree described in the Babylonian era epic is striking. Now we're going to talk about, I'm going to stop there with Block. We're going to talk about the Meshu tree and go back to a little bit of what Block, you know, says about it. But I'm doing this for a reason. When I talk about Ezekiel 31 here, that it has something to do with the world, the cosmic tree, I'm not making something up. This is well known in ancient Near Eastern Hebrew Bible scholarship. Okay, again, it might not be known, you know, you're not going to hear this in church. The flat earthers aren't going to tell you because they want the earth to be flat. They don't want a big tree running through the axis of the earth all the way up to the sky down to Sheol, because that kind of ruins their view, because like you'd see that if it was there. So you're not going to get it there, but this is well known. Again, this isn't idiosyncratic to Mike. It's very well known. Now back to Block. He says, Ezekiel's allegory, he says, is a political rather than mythological statement. Okay, well, you know, we'll see. Those of you who have read Amar Anos's article on the origin of the Watchers and Unseen Realm, you're going to detect pretty soon here that how old Block's commentary is. It's over 20 years old, and he's really missing a lot of information here. But I'm going to read what he says anyway. He says, allusions to the gods, you know, are missing entirely. Well, they are, but of course the abode of the gods is there. The appeal to the Garden of God, he says, carries little, if any, mythological baggage. We're going to find out in a moment how wrong that is. Because the tradition of Genesis 2 would have been familiar to Ezekiel's audience, it provides a useful standard by which the glory of Assyria and Egypt could be measured. For Ezekiel, the superlative cedar of Lebanon represents simply the foremost political force of the day. Again, Block wants to drift away, you know, from seeing too much ancient Near Eastern mythology here. Why? Because he's with a lot of the other scholars that doesn't want this to be about the divine council and the abode of the divine council. He wants it to be about Adam. Okay? So again, both for that reason and also he's writing 20, 25 years before material like Anus, you know, ferreted out for us that I was able to take advantage of an Unseen Realm. You know, it's dated. It's dated material. He also says, quote, Ezekiel's allegory finds its closest analog in another biblical story, Daniel 4, verses 7 through 9. Remember the big tree there with Nebuchadnezzar and all that? But that's a problem too, because that is clearly mythological material. It's not just about Nebuchadnezzar, just like this isn't about Pharaoh. There's a clear Mesopotamian connection with both Ezekiel 31 and Daniel 4, and it's the same connection. Block seems unaware that the Meshu tree gives the account in Daniel 4 and in Ezekiel 31 a distinct mythopoetic, mythological flavor, and that the tree in Daniel is in fact related to the Meshu tree. So it's far more than political. This isn't just a political analogy. There's something a whole lot bigger going on. Now, for listeners, again, if you subscribe to the newsletter, you're going to get an article. I'm going to put an article in the folder that I use for podcast, you know, articles that I reference here, by Silviu Bunta. It's called The Meshu Tree and the Animal Inside, Theomorphism and Theriomorphism in Daniel 4. It's a journal article. Theomorphism is how is God's form or shape described. Theriomorphism is animal form. It's just what it means. It's kind of an odd academic term. But you'll if you read that, you're going to see that, oh, yeah. We've got a lot going on in Daniel 4 that most people don't realize, and we got the same kind of thing going on in Ezekiel 31, and it ain't just political. This is theological messaging, again, through the use of ancient Near Eastern religious thinking. It is all over this chapter and all over Daniel 4. The cosmic tree, again, is not symbolizing just a man, and this is where Block and others want to go, because they're thinking that Ezekiel 28 is just about comparing the Prince of Tyre to Adam. Let's not have the divine council in there. Let's not have a divine rebel in there. Let's not have council rebellion in view. Again, that is quite misguided. You go back to Ezekiel 31 here. The text never says it's about Pharaoh. It's about the nation. It's about the empire. It's about Pharaoh and his multitudes. That empire, with its hubris, is analogized to the great tree. A man isn't the point of the analogy. The might of Egypt collectively and the hubris that goes with it is the point. It will fall just like Assyria did. And when we get to Daniel 4, the message is the same. Nebuchadnezzar, whom God will use in the time period of Ezekiel to judge Egypt, will be subject to the same judgment. And he gets the same imagery, the same messaging. Now, you look at verses 15 through 17 and ask yourself if the description there fits with only one person, Pharaoh. Again, I'm belaboring this because this is how the chapter is typically talked about. Again, so that we're talking about Pharaoh here so we can justify isolating the discussion of the Prince of Tyre in Ezekiel 28 to the man in the garden, to Adam. And again, I'm saying that's just misguided, but let's just stick here. Let's try to stick with just Ezekiel 31. Here's verses 15 through 17. Thus says the Lord God, on the day the cedar, in Hebrew it actually says it, on the day it went down to Sheol, I caused mourning. I closed the deep over it and restrained its rivers, and many waters were stopped. I clothed Lebanon in gloom for it, and all the trees of the field fainted because of it. I made the nations quake at the sound of its fall, when I cast it down to Sheol with those who go down to the pit. And all the trees of Eden, the choice and best of Lebanon, all that drink water were comforted in the world below. They also went down to Sheol with it, to those who are slain by the sword, yes, those who were its arm, who lived under its shadow among the nations. Now here's some questions. Why would Lebanon mourn for Pharaoh? Well, it wouldn't. Well, it's actually mourning for one of its own. Remember, the analogy is about the tree. So Lebanon, the forest in Lebanon, they're not mourning because of a man. They're mourning because of one of their own. The tree, the great tree, has fallen. Now, I'll just telegraph where we're going to go with some of this. The trees here are not representative of people in the garden of God. The trees are representative of divine beings in the abode of God, the headquarters of the divine council. They are mourning. Again, the point of the original rebellion incident, the original problem, the original tragedy is not the fall of a man. It's disloyalty in the council. Lebanon would not mourn for a man. The divine council would not mourn for the man, because God's going to redeem the man. They will mourn for one of their own. Okay. They mourn for the great tree who has fallen. Another question. Did Adam get cast down to Sheol, to the pit? Did Adam, quote, lie with the uncircumcised, which is Old Testament language for being buried, you know, going to the realm of the dead with people who are not the people of God, the Gentiles, the uncircumcised, and not your family? Is that what happened to Adam? Or was Adam redeemed? This does not fit Adam, is the point. It doesn't fit it in any way, shape, or form, but you will have scholars consistently try to make this about the man in the garden. It is not about the man. What about the line comforted? The other trees, you know, comforted by the great tree's trip to Sheol. Well, the verb here in Hebrew is in the Nephal stem, and it can also be translated, they were filled with regret. Very common translation for this lemma in the Nephal. And I would suggest to you that that makes a great deal of sense, and that the ESV has sort of missed an opportunity here to have the passage make sense. Again, every translation has its problems. It's not a crime, just an observation. But the other trees, they're mourning for one of their own, and they are filled with regret. The other trees of Eden joined in this lament. Maybe the point is that this great tree and others like it, okay? Maybe when we bring Assyria into the picture, maybe we have other divine rebels. Remember the gods over the nations? The gods assigned, allotted to the nations, Deuteronomy 32. Again, if you're new to the podcast, I can't go over all this information for you. You have to read Unseen Realm or watch the videos, you know, on the podcast site. Start here. This is why they're there. Remember the gods who were allotted to the nations? They become corrupt. They fall. Maybe the point here, in an extended way, is that we've got lots of problems here with rebellion in the council. Others, like the original great tree, cast down to the pit. That's their destiny. And maybe that's the point. Some of these trees, again, were originally loyal. They were originally part of the forest in Lebanon. They were originally part of the council. And it's not just the great tree that ends up in Sheol, but there are others that end up in Sheol. Others that will go down to the pit. And there's regret. Now, again, just to labor the point, it's just not about the man in the garden. This is about a divine rebel cast down to the pit, and other rebels like him are going to be cast down as well. Now, it could be, again, and it's difficult to tell because it's poetry. Hebrew stems and conjugations don't have, you know, ways of specifically plotting out their time and the chronology. This might be the only place that I know of where you could suggest that when the great tree fell, okay, the original divine rebel, Genesis 3, he's the Nakash, Isaiah 14, it's Hillel ben Shikar, the shining one, the son of the dawn. When they go bad, others went bad with them. And we don't have a reference here to a third of the trees. We don't have a third of the angels and all that stuff. But it's possible, I'm not convinced of it, but it's possible that there may have been more than one. Again, if we press the analogy to that level, as opposed to others proleptically. You know, look at Ezekiel's writing in the 6th century BC. What happened at Babel is you know, long history. Okay, the gods are a lot of the nations and they go bad. Okay, that could very easily, and I think it is, a reference to what's going on here. But you could press the analogy to make the other point. The point is that this is not about a man in Eden. This is about the forest itself, the members of the divine council. One of them falls and they mourn. Okay, so the original ancient point of the analogy is divine rebellion. Again, we saw this in Ezekiel 28. Now, that article I referenced, Bunta, about the Meshu tree, he confuses this point as well. And I want to say something about him for those of you who will read that article. He wants the Meshu tree material to be about Adam. And you say, well, how in the world does that work? While we're definitely dealing with a divine council in the context, just like Isaiah 14, Ezekiel 28, Genesis 3, there's a man in Eden. Okay, we obviously can't deny that. There's a man in Eden. But I am denying that this story is about his fall, because he doesn't go to Sheol. He's not unredeemed. He doesn't, you know, lie with the uncircumcised. None of this stuff fits. But nevertheless, Bunta and others, you know, would say they still want to look at this as Adam. Now, Ezekiel 31 shares obvious elements with Isaiah 14, these references to Sheol. Taylor writes this: the use of a cedar of Lebanon as an allegory for a mighty nation is no new thing. Ezekiel used the same idea in chapter 17, and other echoes of the language in this chapter may be found in chapter 19, chapter 26, chapter 28. Isaiah's description of the descent of the king of Babylon into Sheol has distinct similarities, Isaiah 14. And Daniel's description of Nebuchadnezzar's dream uses much the same imagery, Daniel 4, right? Yeah, that's all true, but ask yourself the question, or just make the observation. There's no way to get Adam in Isaiah 14. It's not like Ezekiel 28 when you can appeal to the Septuagint and you can just put him there because of what a translation does with difficult Hebrew. You can't do that in Isaiah 14, and you can't do that in Daniel 4 either. The only way to view all of these chapters that have shared imagery between all of them, the only way that they can all be consistent in the same way is to opt for a divine rebellion being at the heart of the imagery. The awfulness and the pinnacle of unthinkableness of such hubris that one among the council would go astray. If you look at all of the passages through that lens, not just, you know, you know, you pull one out, you pull another one out and say it's about a man. If you look at all of them that way, they are consistent with each other. And again, that's what I'm suggesting here. Now, Bunta, back to him, he'll latch onto the phrase, the description of the Meshu tree as the flesh of the gods. This tree was the flesh of the gods, the stuff from which an insignia, a symbol of the gods is made, which of course, you know, sounds like idolatry. And that's the way it's treated in Mesopotamian stuff. People take the wood from the Meshu tree and they make an idol. Okay. Well, here's the reasoning. Here's how Bunta and others think this is about Adam. Well, humans are the image of God, just like idols were the image of the gods to other people. So therefore, the analogy of the Meshu tree must be to the man, to the human, to Adam. Okay, we have some problems with that too. The Meshu tree accounts never have humans as being created in the image of the gods or a single god. The tree is only said to represent the god, whoever that is, and the idol represents that god. So arguing for Adam is to use the metaphor of the ancient Near Eastern material in a way that the metaphor isn't used in that material. The Meshu tree also isn't the tree of life for humans. So one, you know, you have to wonder, well, why are we connecting it to humans at all? Again, the metaphor can be understood in different ways. That's just what metaphors are. Okay, there's different ways to see the analogy. The Meshu tree, yeah, sure, it's an idol. You know, you may make an idol from it in the Mesopotamian material, and it's associated with the god or a particular member of the divine council. And one could therefore say that since in Ezekiel 31, the analogy is made not just to Pharaoh, generic humans, but to Egypt collectively, the tree that was Assyria, the tree that was Egypt, represents the whole disinherited nations, its people, and its gods. Okay, yeah, well, why not go that direction? Why not say that the Meshu tree represents the whole nation? In other words, you have these gods in the council and they go astray. They're allotted to the nations and they go astray. And so one of the trees in the council is assigned to people and the people represent that deity and he represents them. Why not go for that? Why do we have to say it's about Adam? Why not, again, apply the metaphor in a different way to the relationship of the gods to their nations? Again, I'm just suggesting it. I'm not saying that's the way we should. I'm just saying that we can. Now, to flesh this out, again, pardon the pun there, it's worth noting that the Mesopotamian Meshu tree wasn't unique. It wasn't just one tree. In Mesopotamian material, there, when it talks about the Meshu tree, it's not just talking about one tree. So we're not talking about one tree that has to symbolize or be linked to one human, to Adam. Amar Anos, which is his article on the origin of the Watchers, it's already in that folder. I mentioned it many times. In his article on the origin of the Watchers, he notes on page 310 that, quote, in the Mesopotamian Utuku Lemnutu incantations, some demons are compared to devastating flood, and the demons spawned by the seed of the sky god Anu scorch the land like daylight. They weaken the huge mess trees, the Mesu trees in the forest. Again, these trees are emblematic of the realm of the gods, the council of the gods. There's lots of Mesu trees. It's not just one. And my view is that these trees were considered the flesh of the gods, quote unquote, simply because in Mesopotamian thinking, the idols of lots of particular gods would have been made from trees. Okay, in other words, there's no evidence in the Mesopotamian material that the language was about one tree and one guy. And so it's illegitimate for biblical scholars to use the metaphor that way to defend the idea that, oh, we're just talking about Adam here. Again, that is an illegitimate use of the metaphor. The metaphor does not have that element on its own terms, and it ignores lots of other stuff. Again, Adam didn't go to Sheol. He didn't die among the uncircumcised. He didn't go to the pit with the uncircumcised. Adam was redeemed. And if we look at Ezekiel 31, we're going to find out that Egypt, again, they're not going to have the same destiny as Israel. Israel's going to be raised to new life because of the people of God. Again, the analogy just doesn't fit in a lot of ways the way a lot of scholars want to think about it. So now let's transition now. Okay, Mike, well, we've talked about how it's usually talked about, how the whole tree metaphor, the cosmic tree thing, is usually talked about, how scholars want this to be talking about one guy, one tree, one guy, so that we can say, oh, Pharaoh is being compared to Adam, just like the Prince of Tyre was being compared to Adam. And all this nonsense about these chapters are about rebellion in the divine council, and how that those two chapters, Ezekiel 28, Ezekiel 31, how they fit with Isaiah 14. Yeah, we know that the language is the same. We know that the metaphor is the same. Don't bother us with those details, Mike. Okay, this is about Adam. All these things are about Adam. Because God forbid that we say that Isaiah 14, Ezekiel 28, and now Ezekiel 31 has any relationship to Genesis 3. Oh, we don't want to say that. Again, if you're curious as to, well, why would scholars resist that? Go back and listen to the episode on Ezekiel 28. And what I'm saying is, yeah, that is what's going on. These chapters are related. The metaphors are the same. The language is the same. And the reference point is the same. It is not about Adam. It is not about a man in the garden. It is about a divine rebel. That's what all of these things are about. And to be consistent, that's the way we need to treat all of them. Not just one when we think it makes us comfortable for whatever other reason, in our theology or in our scholarship. Okay, so you say all that and you say, well, okay, Mike, what's going on here? You haven't answered the questions you raised. Why the reference to Lebanon? Why the reference to this cedar forest? We know if we read Genesis 2 that Eden has geography that puts it, you know, the Tigris, Euphrates down there by the Persian Gulf. You know what? It's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of miles away from Lebanon. What is going on here? You got to answer that question. You're correct. I do. And at this point, I want to refer listeners, again, subscribers, you'll get this article too, to an article by Edward Lipinski. It's called El's Abode, subtitle, Mythological Traditions Related to Mount Hermon and to the Mountains of Armenia. It's from the journal Orientalia, Lovanienza Periodica. It's published in Belgium. Now, I have to give kudos here to Derek Gilbert. Derek and I had a conversation a few weeks ago, and he started talking about Mount Hermon and the Anunnaki and, you know, the Watchers. And it just wasn't clicking with me, because I had given him, you know, an article, a couple articles, you know, for his book, and it wasn't clicking. And then I realized a little while later, you know what? I thought he was talking about a different Lipinski article. I have one on the furniture of El and a few other things. And I had to go back to my own archives and find this article. And it's awesome. It's awesome. So if I'd never had that conversation with Derek, this wouldn't have gone off in my head, but it did. So, you know, kudos to him, you know, for, you know, waking me up there. Now, this article, like I said, is just amazing. I can't go through the whole thing. It's about 60 pages long. It's a long article. And it's very detailed and it's very dense. So everything I'm going to say here, I'm going to extract from the article a few things. Lipinski goes into mind-numbing detail to establish in various texts, in various languages. He is not making any of it up. Trust me. I mean, go look at the article. You'll find out. You don't have to trust me. Just go look at the article. So here are a few summary points of this, and then we'll tie this into Ezekiel 31, and then, you know, that'll be the essence of our episode here. Lipinski starts out, he points out that, because the article is about where does El live? Okay, El, Ugaritic El, who was the head, you know, of, he was the one who fathered all the other gods. You know, he's the highest authority, the high sovereign, even though Baal, you know, who is his co-regent, gets called the Most High and all that stuff in Ugaritic religion. He still has to get permission from El to do things. And we know in the Hebrew Bible that Yahweh, the God of Israel, gets described with both El epithets and Baal epithets. And that's because the biblical writers want to elevate Yahweh above El and Baal. Both, you know, Ugarit was their next door neighbor, you know, of course, religiously, Baal had a big influence. El worship had a big influence on the Israelites. And so the prophets will use this material to say, no, Yahweh, Yahweh and this other guy, El, they're two different things here. You need to worship Yahweh and him alone and all that stuff. Okay. All of that said, there was a lot of speculation, both in ancient times and in scholarship about, okay, Ugaritic texts talk about El's abode. And El's council, where it meets, and all this stuff. Now, we get a description of Baal's. Baal's council is in Safon, okay, the remote north. But what about El's? Now, up until Lipinski's article, most scholars would have put this location, where is El's mountain, at a place called Afka, Mount Afka, near Kibrit Afka. It's a mountain that's between Byblos and Baalbek. And again, for subscribers, I may put this on because I just made this up, you know, myself. But there's a PDF of a map in the folder for subscribers that you can, as you're listening to the podcast, you can look at the map. But there's again a well-known place here between Byblos and Baalbek that most scholars thought, okay, this was what the ancients thought was the mountain of El, the dwelling place of El. Lipinski points out, though, that you know what? There isn't a single Ugaritic text that names this as the place of El and his council. And besides that, Afka is just a common noun. It's never used as a proper noun. So he says, I'm not convinced. I think there's a better possibility. And that's what his article is about. He writes this. It is likely the Ugaritians located the abode of El somewhere in their own geographical horizon, but rather far from Ugarit, since one Ugaritic text says, and this is text 51 from Cyrus Gordon's Ugaritic textbook, if you want that. It's also KTU 1.4, column 5, 20 through 25. It says this. It locates this place 1,000 fields and 10,000 acres distant from Mount Safanu, which was Baal's mountain. So you get sort of a vague description. You know, this is where El's house is, 1,000 fields, 10,000 acres distant from Mount Safanu. So Lipinski seizes on this and says, okay, let's try a few locations out, and let's look in the Ugaritic texts for maybe some vocabulary that we can figure out where this would have been. So the rest of his article, this is what he's doing. And again, catch your breath here. This is what he says. He is convinced, and his article, I believe, presents a compelling case, that the mountain of El for the Ugaritic people, again, would have been in ancient Armenia, but for the biblical people, for the Israelites, okay, what they associated the Ugaritic stuff, the Ugaritic verbiage here, and their own, you know, conception of where El lived, they believed it was Mount Hermon. Lipinski, for example, again, he goes through lots of stuff. He makes this comment. He says, there's an old Babylonian version of the Gilgamesh epic that identifies Hermon and Lebanon with the dwelling of the Anunnaki. Now, the Anunnaki, again, in early Mesopotamian religion, were gods. They were members of the divine council. In later Mesopotamian religion, later texts, they get consigned to the abyss. They become like the lords of hell, okay, if you want to say it that way. But in the old Babylonian text, the story of Gilgamesh, they're just part of the divine council, and the place where they meet is Hermon and Lebanon. The Ugaritic term for Hermon is Sharyan. That is very, 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 very close to Sirion in Deuteronomy 3:9, Psalm 29:6, and 1 Enoch 13, verse 9. So what Lipinski does is he ties all these threads together and basically says, when we're talking about the forests of Lebanon, when we're talking about the cedars of Lebanon, there are other phrases. Cedar Mountain as the abode of El. Again, his article goes through all the data, which I don't have time to just spill it out to you. He's suggesting, again, that Mount Hermon was, to these ancients, the dwelling place of the divine council. This is where they met. And it's specifically actually linked to the Anunnaki in this old Babylonian version of Gilgamesh. I'll even read it to you. This is from, if you have Pritchard's Ancient Near Eastern Texts of the Old Testament, the third edition. This is pages 504 and 505. Again, this is the old Babylonian fragment of the Gilgamesh epic. Gilgamesh is talking to Enkidu. And they're in the forest, okay, and they have to confront this monster, Huwawa. It says, Gilgamesh heeded what his friend said. He took the axe in his hand. He drew the sword from his belt. Gilgamesh struck him, Huwawa, in the neck. This is the guardian monster of the forest. And so they kill Huwawa. He struck the watchman, Huwawa, to the ground. For 2 leagues, the cedars resounded. Enkidu killed him with him. And then there's a reference to the forest cedars. Then Enkidu killed the watchman of the forest, with him, and at whose word, Sarya, which is the Akkadian word for the Ugaritic term, Sharyan, and the Hebrew term, Sirion, at whose word, Sarya, in other words, Hermon, Mount Hermon and Lebanon, trembled. All the mountains became, and then there's the text is broken. All the hills became, text is broken. He slew the gap, and then there's a reference to the cedars. Then it says here, he opened up, they pressed on into the forest, and he opened up the secret dwelling of the Anunnaki. Gilgamesh is there cutting down trees, and the forest is referred to as the secret dwelling of the Anunnaki. Again, without getting into too much detail, because it's tough to translate this to a podcast, Lipinski's article demonstrates that these terms that you run across in these ancient texts, Sharyan, Sirion, a reference to a cedar forest, a cedar mountain. Again, they point to Mount Hermon as being the dwelling place of El's council. And it makes sense, because that's where you have a cedar forest. And not only that, Lipinski goes on for 2 or 3 pages talking about how well watered it is geographically. El's abode in Ugaritic text described as a well-watered garden. Okay, you have the watering motif there, you have the garden motif, you've got the cedars, you've got all this stuff. So again, why the connection with Eden? Because Eden was the cosmic mountain. It was the dwelling place of Yahweh. It was the place where the divine council met to listen to Yahweh and figure out, hey, what's on the task list for today? It's where humans are created to be part of the council. And then to overspread the earth and make the rest of the earth like Eden. The cosmic mountain, the dwelling place of God. This is why Eden, we talked about it in Ezekiel 28. I've talked about an unseen realm. This is why Eden can be talked about as a garden and as a mountain in Ezekiel 28. Okay, it's just where God lives. That's all that the terminology means. It's where God lives, and where God lives, that's where he does business. And where he does business, the council is. Well, one of those biblical descriptions, we have Eden, we have Zion, we have Sinai, and we have Lebanon. Okay, there are references in the Psalms to this. Psalm 42, or we have Psalm 48 that, about the dwelling place of Yahweh, being the heights of the north, the Baal's mountain. But you also get it with references to Tabor and Hermon, again, being, associated with Yahweh. Psalm 42, 6 and 7. Catch the language here. The psalmist says, my soul is cast down within me. Therefore, I remember you from the land of Jordan and from Hermon, from Mount Mizar. Deep calls to deep at the roar of your waterfalls. All your breakers and your waves have gone over me. Again, Hermon, well-watered. It's a forest. Again, there's another, they're just, again, I can't really bring all the references together. And that's why I'm giving you the reading material. But these places are cosmic mountains. These are places associated with where God conducts business. Now, to wrap up here, because I know the episode's getting a little long, but to wrap up, I want to take you back to Amar Anas's article, because he actually discusses a number of these themes, and I'll read you a couple of things from Lipinski as well. And just listen to how this language about Hermon and Lebanon makes sense in the context of the divine council and the watchers and the gods of the council. All these ideas that to listeners of this podcast should be familiar. We'll start with Lipinski here on page 40. He says, according to the Midrash Rabbah on Genesis 33, the cavern of Pan, the cavern of Banias, which of course is on Mount Hermon, was one of the outlets of the deep or the ocean from which came the waters of the flood. A rabbinical tradition identified this with the source of the Jordan, with one of the fountains of the great deep, from Genesis 7, 11, and 8, 2. In accordance with ancient cosmographical ideas, the outburst of water from the cavern of Banias, this is Mount Hermon, has thus been conceived as an eruption of the subterranean ocean on which the earth was believed to rest. On the other hand, the Testament of Levi 2, verse 7, that's a pseudepigraphical text, locates above Mount Hermon a great sea hanging there, which is a celestial ocean. Again, remember in the Hebrew Bible, God dwells above the firmament, above the waters, and the waters above the firmament. Page 41. The passage, Psalm 42 and others, and in the Ugaritic text, that have two oceans, the double deep, deep calls to deep, the Tahom calling to the Tahom. These passages have the subterranean source of the fountains, springs, and rivers that come out of the earth, and the celestial reservoir from whence comes the rain. They join in the region of the upper Jordan and of the, quote, giant Mount Hermon, whose summit was supposed to reach up to the first heaven. The two oceans are personified and represented as calling aloud to one another through the Tsinorim, through the water tunnels, in 2 Samuel 5:8. And they are connected, again, according to Jewish thinking, inside the mountain, and they burst out from the cave of Banias. This could suggest to localize El's abode in the midst of Mount Hermon, since he was supposed to live at the sources of the rivers, the midst of the springs of the two deeps, the double deep. Annas says this: there are more reminiscences of the Mesopotamian origin of all this, you know, the backdrop, in other versions of the angelic descent myth. Now we're talking about the Watchers. That the Watchers descended to earth with a good intent is in background also in the Aramaic fragment 4Q530, which belongs to the Book of the Giants. Again, some of the Dead Sea Scroll texts, some of the portions of Enoch disagree over whether their intent was good or not. But he says, in this text, in this Aramaic fragment, it contains in a broken context the reference to the Watchers as gardeners at work, nurturing and protecting the trees, which connects the Watchers prior to their apostasy, you know, what they were doing. They were the gods. They were the sons of God. They were these divine beings there to help take care of Eden, take care of the divine abode. This reference to gardeners is to be compared to Jubilees 5:6, where God sent the angels to earth, and the further species and further specifies the reason, in order to instruct human beings and to act with justice and righteousness upon the earth. But of course, they go corrupt. According to Jubilees, only after the Watchers' arrival and sojourn among human beings were they corrupted and led astray by the irresistible beauty of mortal women. The statement in the Qumran fragment that the gardeners were watering may be an allusion to the initial good work, the good mission of the Watchers. But then they go corrupt. On another page, 304 Annas, he says, in an old Babylonian fragment, so he's talking about the same one Lipinski is, an old Babylonian fragment of the Gilgamesh epic, the Cedar Mountain is identified as Hermon and Lebanon. An interesting coincidence of identity. The association of the Watcher's sons with a cedar forest in the Damascus document from Qumran says that they were tall as cedar trees and they had bodies like mountains. And this is a Dead Sea Scroll. Another one. The account of the flood, this is Annas 309, 310. The account of the flood and its results in the Era epic again invites a comparison with Jewish lore about the Watchers and the Giants. In the Qumran fragment 4Q530, which mentions the Watchers as gardeners, there's also a reference to destructive water and fire abruptly doing away with all the flourishing vegetation in the garden under the Watchers' care. The gardeners in this symbolic dream refers to the Watchers and the trees to the Giants. Another Qumran fragment, which is probably a textual witness to the same dream, mentions a garden and a tree with three shoots, which apparently survives the flood. The image serves as a symbol for the preservation of Noah and his three sons. This narrative refers to the Watchers' original mission as culture bringers. Remember that phrase of the Apkallu? If you've read Unseen Realm, you know what we're talking about. When you read Reversing Hermon, you'll know it even more. The Watchers, who were the original culture bringers, had turned to evil, and the final result was their destruction by the flood. Again, all these ideas, here's the point, Ezekiel had access to all this stuff. Or scribes in Babylon who edited the book of Ezekiel into the form we have had access to all this stuff. These ideas in Israelite hands describe a primeval forest, okay, that is the dwelling place of God. Just like in other texts, the language of a garden is used, or the language of a mountain is used. Here we have the primeval forest of the divine council, the well-watered garden abode, the mountain abode of God, also known as Eden, also known as the cosmic mountain. Hermon and the forests right next to Hermon are easy matches for all of these things. The perspective, again, that unites all of this, just think about what we're doing here. We have Ezekiel 28, references Eden as a garden and a mountain, and we have a divine rebellion in there. That's the point of the analogy. We have Isaiah 14, which shares language from Ezekiel 28, that the divine rebel gets sent to the abyss, gets cast down to Sheol, cast down to Eretz, the earth, which is another word for Sheol. The council loses one of its members. We have Ezekiel 31 that describes the same thing, but now we get the element of that the great tree has fallen and the other trees mourn. And frankly, it's not over, because there are going to be other trees, other members of this council, who are also going to be cast down and take up residence in Sheol in the underworld. All of these things, Ezekiel 28, Ezekiel 31, Isaiah 14, and Genesis 3, utilize the same metaphors, the same point of analogy of a divine rebel, not the man, not Adam. Inserting Adam into all this actually messes up the coherence of all the data. Without him, the mosaic of ideas comes together really, really nicely. Now, that may irritate some who don't want their demonology moved beyond a snake in a garden, and they don't want to hear about a divine council, much less a rebellion in the divine council. But folks, I don't write the stuff, okay? I just try to do some work to understand it and get you to material to help you understand it. And so what we have in Ezekiel 31 is, yet again, another reference to a rebellion in the divine council that is used, in this case, to say, look, Egypt, you think you're great, but nations and their gods who are greater than you have fallen. And to reinforce that point, I'm going to draw on the story of a wonderful being in a wonderful place, right there with his comrades in the divine council on Hermon, okay, right there. And they were judged. As mighty as these gods, these divine beings were, they're better than humans, okay, as mighty as they were, when rebellion against the will of God, against the high God, the most high God, when rebellion against him happens, it will be dealt with. So take heed, because you're nothing special. You're not an exception. You will not be a footnote to this pattern. You're going to be judged, just like they were, and just like others like you, other nations, have tried to flaunt themselves against the will of Yahweh. It's going to be terminated. You're going to be history.
Mike, you know what I think about the Watchers being gardeners? It's just hard to find good help, you know?
It's hard to find good help.
You know, eventually they'll turn on. You know,
right. They start out so well, and then what do you got?
Exactly.
There's always a bad apple in the bunch.
Exactly. No, I like it when you get snowed in. I mean, you go overboard on research. I like this.
Yeah. Went a little haywire.
Now, do you touch on Onassis and Lipinski's article in your upcoming book, Reversing Hermon?
Onassis. Yeah. I mean, Lipinski's is a little peripheral, because there's no direct point of reversal for the Lebanon language. I mean, there Hermon is the major point of reversal, but I basically try to strike points with other texts, and a lot of it's Dead Sea Scroll stuff, that, you know, you're going to pick up, you're going to see threads of it in the New Testament. So, you know, it's just one of those, you can't throw everything you know, into the book, but that's what the podcast is for. You know, the podcast doesn't have a word count, although probably some people wish it would, but it doesn't have a word count. So
well, there you go. I love it. Awesome. All right. Well, next week, chapter 32, correct?
Yep. Chapter 32. We're going to get more about Egypt and more about Sheol.
Okay. Well, good deal, Mike. All right. Well, with that, I just want to thank you, everybody, for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.